This is March 23rd, 2009, and I'm delighted to have a person we haven't heard much from. His name is Bob Marshall. That's what he's known by, Bob Marshall. But his real name is Eduardo Pussar. He was born on October 6, 1949, in Sao Paulo, Brazil. He came to Canada at some point when he was young. Now, this is a bit different. We're not. What's different about this is that Bob Marshall, and I'm going to call him Ed from now on, because that's what I've called him for years. We Canadians called Eduardo Eddie, or Ed.
Well, you know me by my Christian name.
Yes. And so Ed has been an insider Club 22 for a long time. And I think I want to show how we talk. People, you know, just are familiar with me and seen a lot with me. So we're going to go right into this. And so
what's the news, Bob?
The news.
Well, first I want to say hail and farewell.
Who are you hailing?
Hail and farewell to all, to you, to everyone.
That sounds like something. Where did I?
That's Paris Flamand.
Ah, yes, that's right. We'll go into that. Okay. Yes. I want to begin with the news. Last night, I spoke to James Joyce, or some entity who was able to imitate James Joyce, for over 2 hours.
That's tremendous. That's old Bob terminology, old Bob alphabet. That's tremendous.
Yeah, saying that's tremendous is quoting Bob.
Yes.
Yeah. The good news is that we seem to have a medium pretty close to the quality of the evergreens. And this came into my life pretty strangely. And just this week we started working with it. And we had our first session on March 20th. Let me think. March 20th. Yes. Maybe we had one on March 18th. And then we had our first recorded session on March 20th, Connie's birthday. And then we, I had another one. How does this work out? What's today? Yesterday, the 22nd. Right. So I had one. Connie was there for a while, and then she went to bed, and I carried on for another 2.5. It says 3 hours on the audio recording, but there was a bit of preamble before we went into talking to James Joyce.
So any insights from James?
Well, there's a lot of stuff that you can't precy, like I always say with the evergreens, you can't summarize them. You best hear it and experience it. But I'll say this. What came out in this session, one of the interesting points, is Joyce really confided in me. The struggle was making Finnegan's Wake. And he said that as we did this incredible conversation, personal conversation in a way, he said, now this would never have happened, this conversation, if I was alive, if I was in the physical. Because just humans aren't like that. They aren't going to tell you all their personal struggles, or he wasn't of that kind of personality. And so I'm getting the benefit of what he thought, but never told many people. And he had such, it was such a pain to do Finnegan's Wake, and he didn't know where he was going, and he went to mediums a lot just to get anchored, just to find out what the heck was he doing. And he said he went to a lot of gypsies. And he said Nora, his wife, thought he was having affairs and preferred to think that he was having affairs because she was scared shitless of talking to the dead. And she could not accept that he was doing that. And as long as he's having affairs, then he wasn't talking to a medium, and that was good as far as she was concerned. But he wasn't. He was talking to mediums. So it's a whole aspect of Joyce that probably would shock academics or the Joycean scholars because they would project a secular humanist thing on him. And so it's very interesting. And he also, I haven't read all of Richard Ellman's biography, I don't think. I've read parts of it, and I don't remember reading that he had a dog. But he had some kind of terrier dog, and he called it Bobby. So I made a lot of that later in our conversation. But anyways, it was pretty interesting, and that's the good news, that I'm going to be able to do a whole new level of interacting with the astral plane without having to pay Michael Blake Reed and without the limit of it being an hour-long medium. This medium, this person who goes into trance, enjoys it so much. It's all new for the person. Enjoys it so much that he wants to do it, he or she wants to do it all the time. It feels so neat. So that's the big news. And like I guess I would say, Bob, it doesn't surprise you that I come up with things like that, because you're used to this. This is what I do.
So, Bob, would you say that this new medium has the potential of having as long an involvement with you and Connie as the Evergreens? You said it's almost at the level of Michael Blake Reed. Does that mean that as of now, from what you've experienced from this new happy, willing, engaging trans channeler, that they have the potential of going as long and having as many hours as you and Connie, as you and Carol? I call Connie Carolyn.
Yeah, we can call her
Carolyn. Yeah, Carolyn. So you and Carolyn, does this new happy, engaged, willing, eager trans channeler, do you think has as much longevity potential as Michael Blake Reed?
Yeah, it's actually as good as, but I've only had two sessions, and they're pretty good. Carolyn thinks that she heard the first part with James Joyce, and then she had to get up early, so she had to go to bed by 10 or something. So she said to me today, she said, that was incredible. The casual way of conversation,
we have this one.
Yeah, no, it was just flowed like it was a human being right in the room.
So different than the Willows.
Different
than the Evergreens. Different than, what's her name out in England?
Glow. Yeah, Glow.
Yeah, what's going on with Glow?
Well, she's a computer person.
Steve said she reappeared recently.
Yeah.
Somebody told me she reappeared.
Yeah, you can go back several posts and, you know, go back a few pages on Five Bodies and find the Glow post. I'd probably say something, Glow is back or something. You read that.
Okay.
About six months ago, I got in touch with her, and she had got a job. She's a pretty good computer person, got a job, ideal job for some computer company designing stuff. And so she's very happy doing that, and she's not looking at ghosts. I mean, she can see them, but she's not focusing on it right now. She's got to raise her child.
Are you able to tell us the name of the new medium or no?
No, that's what I can't do.
Okay.
It's shocking who it is.
But
did you hear that?
That's almost like telling us their name, Bob.
That's right. It's like
so shocking and engaging, willing, happy medium. Can we say that? Can we describe this medium?
Here's a point. The medium says they prefer not to be called a medium, but a large.
So size does matter.
What?
Size does matter.
No, I think I can't say this person is large, but they want to think.
No.
The experience is large.
Yeah. So they're talking about the amplitude of what they are able to engage with.
Yeah. Which is a neat idea.
That's exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, we have this one. We have a medium. No, it's not a medium. It's a large. We have a large here.
Yeah, well, I've been present for the Willows. I've been present for Michael Blake Reed. I've been present for Glow. I've been present for... Who was the first one? Remember the tarot card reader, Bob? That Marilena? Remember my girlfriend, Marilena? You remember. She came to the house.
Yes. What the...
And remember, we went to her. It was a woman who was a tarot reader astrologer. You and Carolyn went to her once.
Yeah.
And then there was the woman out in B.C. What was her name?
Teresa. You did Teresa.
So, I did Teresa. I didn't do the Willows. I know Glow. I mean, I know of them, but the only ones I did were... And it's funny because I was going through my... You know, all my stuff was in storage for years and years and years.
Yeah.
All my archives. All of my rare stuff And I was poking through one of the boxes yesterday, or the other day, a couple of weeks ago. And I came across my Evergreens reading that I shared. I split a half an hour, I think, with Dave.
Was it Deb or Dave?
I don't remember. It could have been Deb. It could have been Dave.
Okay.
I think it may have been Deb.
Okay.
Anyway, so...
did you listen to it? Did you listen to it?
Oh, no. I was asking you if you remember the name of that the tarot card reader. It was a woman that Marilena and I went to. You and Carolyn went to her in Toronto.
Carolyn, do you remember the tarot card reader in the early 90s in Toronto that Ed and Marilena went to? Who was that? Redhead?
Yes. Yes, she was a redhead.
Yeah.
It's redhead.
And what did she do with our tarot cards, or what do you recall that reading? Is that on tape?
Does Carolyn remember her name?
You don't remember her name, Carolyn.
I have it. I have the tape. I just have to dig through that. Now, anyway, I'll come up with that one. So there's been many, many mediums, many trans channelers that I've been introduced to from Bob and Carolyn, and now there's a new one.
Yes. Now, are we having this experience of what we call in Toronto Club 22, which you were one of the original members of, are we New Age flakes, me and Carolyn?
Absolutely not. Who made that ridiculous charge? Where's that grievance coming from? Who the hell called you New Age flakes?
What the hell did they
Bob introduced you to crop circles 20 years before anybody even knew, before it even reached the mass media. And, no, that's ridiculous. Where did that come from? New Age flakes?
I think
That sounds like a charge or a grievance levied against you and Carolyn from somebody who just doesn't get it. That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah, it's from alt.slack.
Alt.slack. So Bob's hoiking up alt.slack so that I can, unknowingly just very honestly say that's ridiculous. You're the furthest things from fucking New Age flakes. You're the ones who exposed to me the New Age flakes.
Yeah.
And so does Paris. Paris Flamont. The reason I keep bringing him up so much is that I just finished listening to that wiretap, one of the wiretaps. Incredibly sober guy. He talks about his library. 7,000 books. The only person who can rival that is Bob.
Yeah.
And I know because I have some of Bob's, Bob, you gave me so much stuff that my archives are a small, puny, tiny little, After Effect image of your archives.
And you built the shelves in New York.
I built many libraries for Bob and Carolyn. Yes, I built the library. I built the shelves that housed the library up at City Island.
Yeah. But back to Paris. Let's talk about Paris Flamont. I just think I was incredibly lucky to find someone who knew Garrett, in the 50s. That's what was Garrett Dean. To find someone, and you were a witness of those early emails back in early 2008 when I accidentally found them. And so go into what do you make of the way he talks or what he has to say about Garrett.
Well, I've only listened to, there's how many of Paris Flamont's are there? How many hours did you do with
it? It's not more than 3 hours.
Okay, I've listened to about an hour.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit more. And my impression of him is just, I would love to meet him. He is honest. He is erudite. He's perceptive. And I really enjoyed listening to the way he was describing. I mean, he's a living historical document.
Yeah.
The way he was talking about the village, and it's interesting because you make an emphasis of him and the connection between him and Garrett Dean. But in many respects, when I listened to that 1 hour, there was very little about Garrett. You kept revisiting Garrett, but I was fascinated by the way he was talking about how he had to leave New York, in 71.
Yeah.
The village was dead, and especially the way he was just very, very honest. He was talking about Steve McQueen.
Yes.
And what a vulgar, uneducated, punk he was. Well, punk was the word you kept using.
Yes.
He didn't necessarily disagree with you.
Yeah. But he kept it. You know, I wonder if he represents old European culture style that you might have got when you were young in Brazil or something European, because you got Italian in you. Is there something European in him?
Well, I mean, he's got a very European-sounding name.
Yeah.
Laurent sounds either French or Belgian or, I mean, it's Flamand,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So he is he's very, very very well educated, very cultured, and just very erudite. I really enjoyed listening to him.
I don't think you've heard the part where we go into the Ginsberg poetry scene, the Beatnik.
No, I haven't heard that yet.
You're going to hear he was disgusted with those guys because they didn't know how to do poetry from the classical way, and it's interesting to hear someone critique. If he went into some local cafe or, you know, open mic situation today, he would think that, and all these guys claiming they're poets, he would say these guys were just lunatics.
Well, how did he describe it? He said that a lot of the counterculture people, you know, the minorities, he said that in the matter of the space of 3 months, the racial ratio of the village.
Yeah.
Changed dramatically. You started to probe him about that, and I didn't get very far, much further to the tape, where you're probing him about this racial,
immigrants.
Yeah, the immigrants, but the way he was describing Garrett, he said, Oscar Wildean, and,
yeah.
Of a different era.
Yeah.
So it's almost as if Garrett, even then, was, you know, of a different time.
Oh, he was. He was, when I knew him, he was Oscar Wilde. That's what everybody thought. They thought of Oscar Wilde. And Garrett knew he was Oscar Wilde and talked about him. And it's interesting to meet someone. That was in Nova Scotia, but to meet someone who knew him and saw him that way, you know, from back in 50-51 was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And but he did say, I think what you're getting at is that Paris Flamin knew a lot of people. And Garrett was sort of...
He said, my acquaintances and the people I have met are legion.
Those are
the exact words. He said, they are legion. He's met thousands of characters, both minor and major. Everyone from Steve McQueen to that who was that guy who was the heir to a fortune and said he didn't have anything to prove?
I forgot about that. I forgot who that was. But the fact he was the producer of Long John Neville's show in the late 50s, early 60s, he met a lot of people that way. But he knew people as he ran a salon. You'll hear later, little Bobby Zimmerman showed up and was going to be in the salon in 59, 60. But he didn't get in. Paris held these salons and people would come and perform. But he would say that Garrett was just one unique character among many.
Yes, that's what he said. He said, you know, Garrett, yeah, exactly that.
Yeah.
It's almost as if your connection to Paris is Garrett, but it becomes so much more because his scope and all the people he met is so broad and so far-reaching that there's so much more to Paris than just a connection to Garrett.
Right. But he did say in his email to me, and he might have said it on the show on the interview at one point, that there was only one or two people that he did meet among the unique people who had nobody could be them or redo them. They were so unique, and he said Garrett was one of them. He was uniqueness squared, you know.
Yeah. So that's the specialness of Garrett that, you know, that Paris was aware of.
And
in spite of the legions of others that he met that were equal, and it was just so, I felt almost envious of the way he said that, where are they living now? They're living in some backwater community because there's no interesting, engaging, intellectual, vibrant, you know, humans here.
Yeah.
And he's in a drought, you know, I mean, even at this age, you know, at this age, he's still starving for, you know, a community of people like that. And he spoke a bit in a very romantic way, in a way that, you know, the bygone era, and it's obsolete, you know, you don't have that level of engagement. And I was it was very poignant
yeah,
to hear him speak of the loss of engaged individuals with conviction in their own identities.
Right. The he says.
Can you think of Antonin Artaud?
Yes. He says near the end that something might attract his attention for a while, and he'll talk to his wife about it. And he says, well, maybe I would like to live for another 10 years, 20 years. Then he pauses, he says, and he goes, nah, I want to die. This world's ridiculous now, is what he says.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to be trapped in that kind of sensibility. I can understand it because he was at the center of something, and that's so much of his identity. And it's too bad. I think it's great to have his interview on there just to show a sensibility among all the other people. I mean, compare that to a Doug Carr or a Will Erickson or an Ad Absurdum. You know, now I'm not putting them down, but just you can see the difference for over 50 years of the kind of young minds that are created now.
I completely agree, and I'm very drawn to that level of erudition and that level of expression that Paris possesses and that he expresses. I don't know why. I guess it's for the same reason I'm drawn to the cash flow, you know, in a different way. There is a certain sensibility, a certain level of engaging and expressing that is just, it's a preference.
Yeah, I would say it's because you're a semi-literate, let's talk McLuhan language, you're semi-literate, and the semi-literate romanticizes a highly literate person.
I like the print-oriented bastards and bitches.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's why I like London. Sandra London. There's a level to her that is, she's a print-oriented bitch.
Yeah.
And I enjoy that. It titillates the mind. You know, and that's what you said on Plaza of the Mind with the two guys. You said, I love thinking. I love figuring this shit out. And, you know, you get a little burst of a little ecstatic burst every time you convince yourself that you think you've reasoned this to a level of understanding.
Yeah.
So understanding is a little mini orgasm. You know, it's a what do the French call the orgasm? Le petit mort.
Yeah.
It's a little death. You know, and the people who are able to give you that intellectual little death, that little tiny death, you know, then you're reborn again. It's much more ecstatic. And again, like you said, Bob, not taking anything away from the Erickans and the Absurdums and the Cars with a K, not a C.
Doug Carr, yes.
Yeah, Doug Carr. And but it is different.
Yeah, well, and the but I'm saying that you're a semi-literate. You didn't get that kind of education as a kid. You were a street kid, and I'm saying that.
But I got it later. I got the benefits of a classical education later.
Yeah, you went to University of Toronto at some point, right?
I went to Ryerson for 1 year, and then I went to U of T for 3, and then you know, my brother was killed in Saudi Arabia in 94, and then I left U of T. It was a monumental event for me to have my brother killed suddenly.
Right.
And then I tried to go back and decided that the classical education fetish had run its course.
Right. So what did you take at U of T? I know you took some POMO courses.
No, I studied, I jumped around a lot, but in the end, I focused on semiotics.
Yeah.
Philosophy and Italian language and literature.
Now, are you an Italian deeper than a Canadian?
No, the way I feel is I'm Brazilian first.
Right.
Then my second sensibility would be Italian, and then my third sensibility would be Canadian. And that kind of fits with the linguistic theory. My very first language, my very first understanding of language was Portuguese.
Right.
My second understanding of language as an ordering system, as a categorizing, cataloging system, was Italian. And my third language was English. And English was the most painful because when I came to Canada, I was already an adolescent, early teen,
right.
And I couldn't speak a word of English, so I had to learn very quickly, and the speed up of having to absorb this new system of communicating meant that I suffered a lot. There was I was beaten up after school because we were the immigrant kids who didn't speak English well. So,
it means you were a stranger. You had to be beat up.
Yeah. So, but with that, yeah. So they beat up all the kids who couldn't speak English very well. And I remember thinking, "Fuck this! I'm going to learn this language. I'm going to master this fucking language, and then I'm going to beat these fuckers up."
Did you do that?
Yes, I did.
So you became a street scrapper?
To a certain degree. I tried to avoid that because there was a lot of violence at home.
Yeah.
My father fought against Mussolini, and he was in the partisan resistance movement in Trieste, where Joyce spent quite a bit of time. So my father, a very young man, was captured by the Nazis, along with his cousins, his uncle, and other members of his family. And he was tortured by the SS. They said, "You must be the leader of this resistance cell." And because this is an interesting thing. My father could speak German, Croatian, and Italian at a very young age. And he was able to convince the Germans in German that, no, he was not, in fact, involved. And they believed him, but not after they had pistol-whipped him and tortured him, tied to a chair for hours and hours and hours. So they said, okay.
Wait a minute. You're saying they pistol-whipped him, he didn't give in, and then they believed him?
They believed him because he was able to speak to them in German.
But that's after they tortured him.
Yeah, as they were torturing him, he was speaking to them in German.
Yeah.
And then they said, okay, we don't think anybody could, take this kind of punishment and not crack, and you haven't cracked, so obviously you must be telling the truth. But then they shot his cousin right in front of him. They said, well, then your cousin must be... So he suffered this incredible trauma.
Yeah.
And...
Why was he there in Trieste? He wasn't in Brazil yet.
Oh, no, this was... My father was born 1925. So he would have been 16 or 17 during the war, and he didn't get to Brazil until after the war, I think 1948.
Okay.
1947 or 1948, because after World War II, no European wanted to stay in a completely destroyed Europe.
Yeah.
It was a mass accident.
I know. I was there. I saw it.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So that's what propelled my father to emigrate.
And so he goes to Brazil.
That's the drama of language. The fact that my father was multilingual in some weird total biology way. I've been reading total biology, and it's part of that. It's all part of me always being. I mean, I'm multilingual now. I speak fluent Portuguese. My mother. I speak fluent Italian, fluent English, and fluent French.
Yeah.
And I've always had this insatiable desire, to learn more languages. And even when I was in New York and hanging out with Galia, I was just thinking, can I learn Russian?
Yeah, Galia.
And her two kids were trying to teach me Russian because I was tutoring them in English. But I could never, I was much older then, and I thought, Russian is not even a, it's a different language. But I was always the ability to speak as many languages as possible.
Because of your father.
I think there must be some weird, mystery body, connection between the fact that my father is multilingual and that I'm multilingual, and I've always been enamored with absorbing more and more different, linguistic structures.
Right, and we just say that Galia was the daughter of the private secretary who worked with Kosygin, the famous foreign minister through many Soviet, presidents.
Bob and Carolyn introduced me to Galia.
Yeah. What was interesting about her is that she had some books by McLuhan as a young person, I guess in the 70s, but she had to keep them hidden. You weren't allowed to have anything from the West, I guess. Couldn't have McLuhan books, though.
Oh, it was incredible, Bob. I mean, I went on to spend a lot more time with Galia and her husband. What was her husband's name?
Steve. He was an American Mormon.
I spent so much more time with them after, because I went on to be like, well, I tutored the kids.
Yeah.
And God, I would come. She gave me, do you know I had keys to her apartment?
Yes, you told me that, yeah.
And I would just show up. You know, the kids loved me. They adored me. And I really remember that time fondly. And I would show up, and she would be on the phone. And she was just so happy and so friendly all the time. And she would be speaking furious Russian to somebody. So I just let myself in, and I'd motion. I'd put my finger up to my lips, shh, you know, and she'd be, like, waiting. I'll be off the phone. And she'd be speaking Russian. And I'd let myself in, take off my shoes, make myself comfortable. And then after about 5 minutes, she would get off the phone, and she would say, in this thick Russian accent, I'm so sorry, but I was talking to Yeltsin. I was talking to Boris Yeltsin. Sure, you're talking to Boris Yeltsin. Who am I to interrupt that? But just fascinating, one of the many, many fascinating experiences I had in New York.
Thanks to me and Carolyn.
Everything was thanks to you and Carolyn.
I'm looking at...
I wouldn't have been in New York if it wasn't for your Carolyn.
Right. I'm looking at two cups that Galia gave us. They were the drinking cups they used in the Kremlin. Do you remember those? They had the little
tea. No, I don't.
The little tea.
The little cups. Small.
Yeah, and they had the cups inside, but we've got the outer container with the elaborate design. These were used
right.
in the old Soviet Kremlin, and she gave two of them to us. So it's one of the few things I brought from New York.
City Island.
Yeah. So we were talking about you, though, and the, you know, the scrapper, you were beat up, your father was beat up. I beat you up.
Here's what's interesting about my father's drama, and it's always difficult for me to talk about him because he was such a, he was a very damaged human being.
Yeah.
I think that the whole experience he never talked about his wartime experience. It was only when I traveled to Italy for the first time that I met my cousins there, and they said, you don't know? And they were angry with me because I wasn't aware of my father's history.
Mm.
And I got angry back because I said, listen, he's never talked about it. So how can you, you know, fault me for not being fair of his history? But where was I going with that? I was talking about how...
He never told you.
Right. So after his experience being pistol-whipped by the Gestapo, they let him go. And then in short order, I think a week later, I mean, he went into hiding because he knew that it was only a matter of time before they discovered that he had duped. So he was a dead man. And he's 17 or 18 years old. And my aunt there, she told me that they had to hide my father in a well, a water well. They lowered him into a well, and he spent 4 months living inside this well so that the Nazis wouldn't find him and kill him. So I think that damaged him. It damaged him in a very profound way. So he was very, he's a very violent man, very violent and very angry, and didn't know what to do with the trauma that he suffered.
Yeah.
Well, very difficult to talk about him, but...
When he got to Brazil, what did he do? Didn't he have some pretty good job?
Yeah, he worked for Volkswagen. It was a massive Volkswagen plant in Brazil, and he worked for an elevator company called Brown and Boveri.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was a mechanical engineer. He was he was trained as a mechanical engineer, and he went there to work in the Volkswagen factory, and then he worked for Otis Elevators. You'll still see their stamp. If you go into any building, it's usually, you know, there's only four major elevator manufacturers in the world, and Otis is one of them.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was young, my father had a jumpsuit from Otis. No, from Brown Boveri. Brown and Boveri was another mechanical engineering firm. And I remember that as a teenager, I took great pleasure in taking that jumpsuit and dressing up in it.
Well, what's a jumpsuit? You mean somebody worked on the plant floor?
Yeah, like you know when you go to a gas station, you see a guy in a monkey suit. It's like it's a coverall.
Right.
It's a one-piece garment used by mechanics and people like that to work on different machinery.
And you wore that in Brazil or when you came to Toronto?
No, I wore that when I came to Toronto.
Okay, so he has a trauma in Brazil with the coup.
Oh, no. Now I remember what I was going to say. So here's what I worked of years later, because I went through a period of really hating him and not understanding how someone could be so cruel to his own family, beating up my mother and all kinds of abominable, objectionable, criminal behavior. And then I started to meditate on what he went through. So here he is. He's 17 years old. He's tortured by the Gestapo. He's almost murdered by them. He narrowly escapes with his life. And that was the conditions of, being under, fighting against Mussolini and all of that. So what does he do? He emigrates to Brazil. And he thinks he's going to have a new life. Everything's going to be fine. So what happens in Brazil? 1964, military dictatorship backed by the CIA, actually created by the CIA, overthrows the civilian government. So now there's martial law, the military's in the street, and my father's thinking, I can't live through this type of thing again.
Yeah.
So totalitarianism visits him for the second time in his life. So what does he do? He's like, okay, we gotta get out of here. I'm gonna take my young family and we're gonna go to Canada. So many immigrants back then, well, what happened was the father or the male household leader of the family, they would go in advance and they would secure employment and a place to live, and then they would send for their family. So that's what my father did. He came to Canada. Bob, when was the FLQ crisis here?
October
1970. So here it is. My father escapes the Nazis and Mussolini and the fascists. Goes to Brazil. What happens there? The new fascists, backed by the CIA.
And the Nazis. That's part of the Fourth Reich. That's the same Galen network that the
guy. Exactly.
Yeah.
But it gets better. So what does he do? He comes to Canada, the promised land of all immigrants in 1970. He lands in Montreal, and he's rounded up by Pierre Trudeau's fucking guards. The first time the National Guard. What do they call them? And he's like, I can't believe it. I came to the one country that I would never. And he's rounded. My father was rounded up as an immigrant, which happened to everybody who was in Canada during the FLQ crisis. They were all rounded up. And that, I think that broke him, because basically he knew that he could never escape the drama of fascism. That no matter where he went, he came to Canada, the only place on the planet that had never experienced anything like that since or now.
Yeah.
The only time in Canadian history that the military was deployed in the fucking streets, and my father was rounded up, and I think it broke him. It broke him. It broke his spirit.
I shed no tears for him. Anyways,
And I shed no tears for him as well.
But the thing is, why was he rounded up? What had he done in Montreal?
Nothing. But you have to understand that the climate at the time was that anybody who was not a Canadian was rounded up. And a lot of immigrants were rounded up because they were suspect.
That's only in Montreal, Quebec, right?
Only in Montreal, yeah. He just got swept up. He was just in the wrong place. My father has the distinction of being in the wrong place at the wrong time, but he had no control over it.
Yeah, it wasn't his fault, supposedly.
Well, how did he know going to Brazil that, after a few years there, that there would be an overthrow of the... He had no idea. Who would have ever dreamed,
yeah.
as an immigrant coming to Canada, that there would be, you know, the military in the street?
So what happened to him? He gets rounded out, but that's just, he's only in, you know, in prison for a week or two, right?
No, he was just detained for a couple of days, but it was enough for him to make and match that experience. You have to understand, here's a guy now coming to his third country, you know, and I think for him, what happened in 2 days or 2 weeks or 2 months or 2 years was irrelevant. It was just the fact that it was occurring that made him, I think it broke him.
Right, and he doesn't know if it's going to get worse.
He doesn't know, because now he's lost all faith. There's nowhere else to go. I've come to Canada. This is the place where draft dodgers from the United States came during Vietnam War. And it's like, there is no safe place. So I think for him, it completely shattered his sense that there may be a safe haven of any kind. And that stained his entire family.
Now, he went to Toronto, though. You think that was
Yes. Well, then he left Montreal pretty quick.
Yeah.
And came to Toronto.
But by that time, he can't rely on his professional experience from Brazil to get a job.
That's the second... Very good, Bob. You're always very prescient.
Yeah.
So the second level of my father's being shattered is that... He's now unable to find work in his trained profession. And he comes from a time and an era not unlike Paris Flamand.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the idea of having been educated and trained in a profession that was respected, a mechanical engineer, and unable to find employment in that field, I think further deteriorated his spirit.
Yeah. And
so he had to settle for a job. And here it comes full circle. He settled for a job with the Ontario Provincial Police. My father was and that's basically what the Nazis were. They were provincial police of some kind. So he became his abuser. So
right.
He had a Munchausen. Is it Munchausen?
What's Munchausen?
I think Munchausen.
Baron Munchausen?
Well, where you identify with your... assailant, or you identify, there's a syndrome in
okay.
psychoanalysis where the person who is kidnapped or, you know, being abused identifies with their abuser.
Right.
So in some weird, fucked up way, here's my father, unable to find employment as a mechanical engineer, has to become a military policeman in Canada. So he became... kind of like everything that he was trying to escape from, you know, from fascist Mussolini to CIA-backed, you know, overthrow junta in Brazil to Canada, and he has become a military policeman because that's the only work he could get.
Well, that's Ontario Provincial Police are not military. What do you mean by that?
Well, they're not technically military.
Right.
A policeman is a policeman is a policeman is a policeman.
Right. So that, what did he do? Did he do bodyguards or security?
No, he patrolled the government building downtown.
At Queen's Park?
At Queen's Park, yeah. My father patrolled Queen's Park.
So he right there opposite McLuhan?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, 100 yards from McLuhan.
Yeah, right across the street, actually, from St. Joe's College.
Had you ever
he was maybe, what? 100, 200 meters from the coach house.
Yeah, did you?
MacArthur Block. My father was stationed. I used to go visit my father at work at MacArthur Block, which was like 200 meters from the coach house.
McLuhan's coach house, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the only coach house.
Yeah.
The other coach house? what coach house are you fucking not telling us about, Bob?
Yeah, we'll get to that. But we'll go ahead. So you would visit him.
Yeah.
At MacArthur Block.
Yeah.
And did you ever put the two, McLuhan and him down? We've never mentioned that before. Have you ever?
No, that's a new insight.
Yeah, to him standing, guarding the enemy of McLuhan, so to speak.
Well, yeah, he was guarding nothing. There was nothing to guard. I think that further kind of dissolved his sense of identity, because he knew that he was doing a meaningless task.
He was guarding the Gestapo, the political Gestapo.
Well, no, he was guarding nothing. There was nothing there. There was nothing to guard. That was the ridiculousness of his job. And I think he felt it very acutely, you know, that he knew that the rest of his working life would be, you know, engaged in nothingness. I mean, he was the caretaker, you know, of the interior of a postmodernist nightmare, you know, an air-conditioned postmodernist nightmare. And I remember, you know, seeing him come home, you know, because he worked night shift and swing shift, and he was destroyed. He was destroyed. You know, it corroded him. I think it disintegrated his very sense of self. You know, that this was his lot. You know, that he would have to, you know, basically be patrolling these empty, you know, extremely well polished granite floors. He was the keeper of the polished granite floor. Nothing ever happened there.
Yeah, you know? You're not talking about the Queen's Park, the green roof buildings or whatever. You're talking about down opposite Ontario Hydro.
No, McDonald Block. They moved them around. He would go from McDonald Block to Queen's Park proper, the green, yeah, you know, copper roof building. Then from McDonald Block, they would put him in Fraser Block. They would put him in any government building that needed him. So they moved him around a lot.
Was he the only guy doing... Was there many people? Was there five people he'd rotate with?
Oh, yeah. There was a huge core of people who had the same job as he did.
And he would sit there and read a newspaper or something?
Yeah, he was a glorified, you know, night watchman.
And he had a uniform.
But they gave him a fancy title. They called him Special OBP Constable. He had a gun. He had a badge. I used to play with his handcuffs,
yeah,
which would infuriate him. He'd come home, and I'd have handcuffed myself to one of the radiator pipes. but I had his keys, you know, and he just. Yeah.
You couldn't leave. You couldn't move till he came home.
Well, my father's a very formal person, you know, and to him, you know, kids didn't play. It didn't play. They weren't supposed to play. He was kind of like McLuhan. McLuhan was to his kids.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, kind of not there, detached.
Yes. So he was in a bad mood all the time.
Always. I rarely remember seeing my father happy. But it's interesting, you know, Claire... Dunphy, who Carolyn also introduced me to.
Who right now is in Bali, and I haven't heard from Buzz Cosin, but he just visited her the other day in Bali.
I love that. I love it. Here's Buzz Cosin. Buzz Cosin's what? He's like 14 months, no, 16 months new to Bob?
No, he's only, since September 30th, so October, November, 5 months.
He's 5 months new to Bob, and he's now involved with a very important person in my life, Claire Dunphy, who Bob and Carolyn introduced me to, who saved me. She rescued me. She gave me a place to live. I had a $1 million condo on the Upper East Side.
Yes.
While she's off in Bali.
Yes.
And it all happened, you know, in this, like, hallucinogenic way. Carolyn goes, I'm going down to a moon ceremony. And my friend Claire, you should come. So I go, okay. You know, I always love hanging out with Carolyn because she's such an antidote to Bob, right? It's like, you know, Bob's like, you know, Bob's the father.
Bob's relentless. Like, Bob's relentless.
So I'm going to get out of the house and go out with Carolyn. So, and a bunch of women, and I love being around women. So I went down to Claire's, and we're doing the moon ceremony, and I go, oh, this is fun. And then I start talking to Claire, and we get along real. She goes, you know, Eduardo, I'm going to Bali in a week, and I'm going to go for 6 months, and I need a house sitter. And at that point, I had no idea where I was going to be living, because
yeah,
I was staying with you and Carolyn, and I couldn't stay there indefinitely. It wasn't going to work.
I was too relentless.
Yeah, you were too relentless, and Claire, you know, came along, and then I had this incredible $1 million condo on the Upper East Side. And now Buzz Coasting, who's used to the whole Bob and Carolyn world, is gonna, well, has, should have already met with
Claire.
Claire.
Yeah, the Okay, so we're talking about your father, who's always grumpy. Did you visit your friends, your peer groups, you know, teen friends, and did they have happy fathers? Did that give you a view of parents, a distorted view of parents, or you knew your father was a special case?
Well, I always knew that, the friends I had, their parents weren't like my father, so.
Yeah. So did you avoid hanging around home?
Oh, yeah, you know that, Bob.
That's what I meant by being a street kid.
Yeah. Well, I was a little bit old. I was already 13, 14, and I pretty much spent as much time away from the house as possible.
Yeah. So what did you get into in your teens?
Well, you know, I was just out being free and wild, you know, rock and roll.
But then how did you get into theater?
Oh, theater. Well, I got into theater in high school. I did high school here in Canada, and that was challenging. I got into theater in high school, and then later on, I stayed in touch with the high school for doing the theater, and was always interested in what was going on with the theater program. I did win that one award from Theatre Ontario, and I was the only student that had ever won a theater award, so I enjoyed acting, you know.
Well, how did you have that ability?
What's that?
How did you get that ability to be an actor?
I don't know. I guess it was innate or natural, like an athlete.
Maybe it was the language. You like...
It was the language. I was always the class clown, the dreamer. I mean, because the situation at home was always so negative, you know.
Yeah.
That for me, you know, when I came to school, I loved school. I used to have these fantasies of going to boarding school, and I'd watch movies. The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz.
Right.
And there's a scene in The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz where Duddy Kravitz gets sent off to boarding school. His parents, they're rich Jews.
Yeah.
Send him off to boarding school. I remember watching this film, and who was the, it was Richard Dreyfuss.
Yeah.
Richard Dreyfuss played Duddy Kravitz. And I remember thinking, my God, what a great dream it is to be able to go to boarding school. But for him and for other kids, it was always like a horror.
Yeah.
Or a great terrible tragedy to be sent away. Whereas for me, I longed for it. And I fantasized, and I was like, wow, boarding school would be the greatest thing ever.
Yeah, the...
But anyway.
So you're doing the acting, and that's how you meet my foster kids.
That's right, because I stayed in touch with my school, and Paul and Shannon got interested in that. And I remember being involved with them.
Yes.
You know, sort of as a mentor, you know. I was like, oh, you guys are getting into, you know. Well, Shannon didn't get into it that much, but Paul did. Paul was really interested in it, so that's how I got connected with them.
So we were talking, we get into your father, which was nicely led into a bit of your roots, which is good.
Yeah.
I didn't know we were going to go that way, but we were talking about you, and you started to think about the total biology and the effect of your father.
Oh, right, yeah.
Bring it back to yourself. Like, what is it that this all did to you? Why did you get interested in Mae Brussel and Zappa and all what I call the holy offices?
Well...
Because you knew of them before you met me.
Well, here's, you know, I mean, a little bit of my background. I mean, I was always very rebellious. I was the black sheep of the family. My brother, not so much. I had two brothers. One brother died when he was 2 months old. I never knew him. That's not something I want to talk about right now. That's a very horrible story of how my first brother died. And
was he born before you?
He was born before me, and he only lived for 3 months. I never knew him. And then my older brother, Mauricio, who died in Saudi Arabia, he was very different than me. He looked a lot like my great-grandfather, who's Lebanese.
Right.
But Uncle Bill Salem Malouf Said. And it was incredible, this fitting image of him, because my brother had dark hair, olive complexion, dark eyes, and I'm completely different. I'm fair, and it was always this strangeness, how my brother took after this one, you know, part of my family, and I didn't. So I looked a lot more like my father. My father looked a lot like Clint Eastwood when he was younger.
Is that right?
Yeah. So and my father was actually in a Dino De Laurentiis film. My father was a bit of an extra. He acted in when he was in Italy. He was in a Dino De Laurentiis film as an extra. So what was the distinction I was trying to make here about? What were you asking?
About Mae Brussels. Why did you get into? You were the black sheep.
Yeah, I always had this black sheep, anarchic. I was always questioning. I think a lot of that came from the brutality of my father.
Yeah.
You know, he always made me fight back. So I was always, you know, suspect of things and always interested in, you know, issues surrounding, you know, what happened in Brazil. You know, and...
Oh, yeah, the coup. Well, the coup would have made you think differently.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, I was always, you know, in class, I can remember, always asking the teacher why. She would give us a pat answer, and I'd say, well, why is that? And they would always be annoyed. They're like, why is this annoying fucking kid who's not even from this country? Why is he fucking probing us? They didn't want to work. They didn't want to, like, I'd ask the difficult question. I always liked asking the difficult questions because they always rewarded me more. I was like, and the intrigue of, well, you don't have an answer, do you? And all that. So,
well, then
that's where my interest in, you know, conspiracy theory, the story behind the story, you know, my father also drilled it into us. Don't ever trust the government. My father wouldn't let me join the Boy Scouts. I was trying to fit in. Here I am, an immigrant kid, trying to fit in. He wouldn't let me join the Boy Scouts. And you know what he said to me? He goes, the Boy Scouts are a precursor to a fascist organization. He said, I'm not letting you join that. He goes, you'll join the Boy Scouts, you'll lose your interest in hockey, get into drugs. He was always trying to keep us away from authority, because he knew that authority led was a slippery slope. Nationalism, he never wanted us to absorb Canadian culture. He goes, you're not going to absorb Canadian culture. He goes, you're fucked over by every culture trying to absorb. What happens in the end is, you know, nationalism is a slippery slope to fascism. That was his hallucination. Now, for me, you know, I'm a teenager. I want to belong, right? All I want to do is I want to be like everybody else. I don't want to be individual. And the incredible irony of it, the more I wanted to belong, the more individual I became.